Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 168. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around we're looking at a couple of Hitchcock movies. First one is one of his best, 1946's Notorious, starring Cary Grant and Ingrid Bergman. Then we move on to a lesser-known and less successful one, 1950 Stage Fright, starring Jane Wyman and Richard Todd. So sit back, I'll get the contact details out of the way, and we'll get on with the show. Paleo Cinema Podcast is a fortnightly podcast of classic movie appreciation. There are only two rules to the podcast. The first one is that I have to like the film, or it's been suggested by a Patreon subscriber. The other rule is that it has to be at least 20 years old. So none of this new stuff, it's all old, it's all good. So if you want to contact me, you can email at cultguru@gmail.com, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U @gmail.com, or else you can go to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can also go to paleo-cinema.blogspot.com. Now, there occasionally are adult themes and adult language used in this podcast. Just be aware of that as well. You can also leave reviews on iTunes, so if you're so inclined, please do so. It would help the podcast out a lot. So sit back, relax now, and we'll get on with the show. And thank you for listening. Hey, how's everybody going? Let's see, how are things here? Been watching a lot of movies, not been doing too much else, getting a lot of sleep, which is good. Now that I have the CPAP machine to help me with my sleep, I'm very much more alert during the daytime, and obviously that's going to reflect in the quality of the podcast, I hope. So this time around, I'm doing a couple of Hitchcocks. I'm on a bit of a Hitchcock bent, and I thought I'd take a look at two that I hadn't seen before. Both of these movies I'd seen for the first time this month, basically, in the month of August. And the first one was highly regarded, and the second one, I happen to be going through the shelves, of which there are many. Kind of imagine the warehouse at the end of the first Indiana Jones movie, and you'll get the idea of the man cave's collection of movies. And I saw Stage Fright, and I thought, hang on, that rings a bell. And I brought it out, found out it was a Hitchcock, and matched it up well with Notorious. They're both interesting movies in their own ways, both filmed in glorious eye-popping black and white, and they're both from that era before Hitchcock became, in a sense, a brand. They're one's from when he was working in the Hollywood studios in the 40s, and the second one, Stage Fright, he actually made in England as a part of a three-movie deal that he had with a much smaller company. But I like them both. There are really nice things in all of them. There's not really a Hitchcock movie that isn't without features of interest. There are, yeah, you can rank them, I suppose. But both of these ones I enjoyed, and both of them were new to me, so that was a bit of a joy as well. But before we do that, of course, we do what I always do, which is talk about the movies that I've watched lately. I went on a bit of a Western thing. I went on a bit of a retro thing, a few other bits and pieces, but one of the movies that was on my list but hadn't been watched yet was an early Sam Peckinpah Western, Ride the High Country, with Randolph Scott and John McRae at the end of their careers. Quite a good movie. It's got a nice supporting cast too. People like Warren Oates turn up in the supporting cast. It's about a couple of guys who are to escort some gold from a gold mining camp back to town. One of them is less, say, morally, has less of a moral compass than the other, but it's a nice kind of western. It's one of those sunset westerns. It's the end of a career, it's at the end of the Wild West, and it's good early Peckinpah. It was a great one to visit because I hadn't seen it before, and it kind of stands after most of the renowned westerns that Randolph Scott did with Bud Bedecker. In fact, Bedecker was offered this movie and declined it. But if you haven't seen Ride the High Country, it's definitely worthwhile. It does have a bit of a slick studio look that the Bedecker westerns didn't, and that kind of takes away from things slightly, but it's still a good movie. I also dragged out my Criterion Edition Blu-ray of Judex, the Georges Franju movie from the early 1960s, starring a magician called Channing Pollock, and it has Frangia's muse in it, Edith Scob. It's a little bit of a Fantomas kind of story with Julex being a kind of steampunky anti-hero. Beautiful visuals and really nicely done. It harks back to silent films like Le Vampire and all those things, and it was a lot of fun to watch. It's in French, of course, and the transfer being a Criterion edition is very, very good. And yeah, I've really got to find more of those kind of movies to watch. I think the kind of 1950s French slightly fantastic films, which I did enjoy. And speaking of enjoy, I bought a copy on eBay of Ride Lonesome, the Randolph Scott Western. It's part of the renowned movies that Baedeker did with Randolph Scott in the 1950s and 1960s. Thought I was buying an original copy, but I wasn't. I ended up getting a bootleg copy, and I'm going to be offering feedback about that because I paid good money. I thought I was getting a legit copy, but I didn't. The quality was good, but the guy was a bit misleading in it. But just the Western itself, it's got that beautiful pared-down Western feel of the Baedeker Randolph Scott Westerns. They're kind of all of the extraneous frills and whistles are taken off, and it's kind of boiled down to an essence, like the jus you get when you have a good steak in an expensive restaurant. It's that kind of distilled essence of Western. And it's a lot of fun, very striking visuals, good supporting cast as well. James Coburn in his first feature film role. It's also got Pernell Roberts, who later went on to star in the early seasons of Bonanza, and Karen Steele, who was Baedeker's girlfriend, playing the female role and doing it quite well as well. It's just one of those classic Westerns that just doesn't get enough love. Then I went totally in a different direction and saw the second Sin City movie, Sin City, A Dame to Kill For, which has got an ensemble cast. It's got Josh Brolin in it, Eva Green's in it, Mickey Rourke's in it, all of that kind of stark black and white stuff with the fancy CG in the background. Robert Rodriguez, I think, directed it. It does have some prolonged scenes of nudity with Eva Green in it, which from the viewpoint of a heterosexual male is not a bad thing, but I think it's very much a kind of lesser Sin City movie. The first one was original because of the stylistic devices that it used, but this one's a bit less, and the voiceovers kind of work. It's trying to be to film noir what Ride Lonesome is to Westerns, but it just doesn't get there. Nonetheless, that I picked it up very, very cheaply on Blu-ray, so I thought I'd watch it. And yeah, it was slightly disappointing and kind of very, a bit too much aware of its own conceits, if you know what I mean. But nonetheless, wasn't an entire waste of time. And I just paused there to finish my espresso, which is always welcome. I did see an early Al Jolson movie, which fortunately doesn't involve blackface. And it has music and lyrics by Rodgers and Hart. And it's Hallelujah, I'm a Bum, with Madge Evans is in it as well. Harry Langdon, who was a silent movie star, and Frank Morgan, who later went on to play The Wizard of Oz. It's kind of a weird Depression-era musical where Al Jolson plays Bumper, who's the mayor of Central Park, and of course during the Depression a lot of people were camping out in Central Park. He has a relationship with the mayor of New York, played by Frank Morgan, and they have a kind of triangle romantic relationship with the young woman played by Madge Evans. It's a very kind of weird movie. It's very much of its time, and it's got some really funny bits of socialism in it, which is kind of nice. And Jolson sings and dances and all that kind of thing. It's very much of 1933, which is when it was made. But it does show you the kind of entertainment people had during the Depression and the fact that they could take a stab at the rich and come away unbloodied at that time. Later on, of course, with all of the stupid production code and the House on American Activities rubbish, you couldn't get away with that stuff after that. But in 1933, you could. And because it doesn't have Jolson pretending to be a black person, It does have its virtues, and it's a nice little piece of cinema history that I kind of enjoyed. And speaking of cinema history, I'm doing well with the segues today. I saw a documentary by Ted Demme called A Decade Under the Influence about the 1970s and the way it changed American cinema. It does a lot of interviews with people like Dennis Hopper and all of the people involved at the time, and Coppola's in it and things like that. And it kind of reminded me how revolutionary a time in American cinema the 1960s and the 1970s were. In fact, after I finish podcasting today, I'm going to go back and rewatch Dog Day Afternoon on the basis of seeing it in this documentary. I picked it up for like $5 on DVD when I was rummaging a little while ago, and I was in the mood for a documentary, and I watched it, and it is a good overview. It's one of those documentaries about film where you do grab for a pen and paper and you want to write down all the movies mentioned, for the simple fact that you may want to watch them again, which is kind of cool and interesting. And it moves along very quickly. It covers a lot of ground for the length of the documentary, and it does it from original sources, being the people involved in making those movies, and that's kind of nice as well. And on the basis of that, I did watch a movie that I'd had on my DVR, my Foxtel IQ box, Nashville. I watched Robert Altman's Nashville again for the first time in a number of years, and that kind of pseudo-documentary feel he has about it is really interesting. The immensely large cast of characters, the deep sense of absurd realism about it really makes it work, and that killer ending, literally killer ending, just blew me away afresh. And they really did cast a number of people against type. People like Henry Gibson playing Haven Hamilton, the country music star. Lily Tomlin is extremely good in it as well. Ned Beatty is in there, and he's good. Shelley Duvall, of course. Roddy Blakeney. Just the whole ensemble. And Keenan Wynn in a kind of understated and very good role, which doesn't get much oxygen, but really is well cast and well played by Keenan Wynn in the film. Nashville, it's one of those movies that you're not going to watch terribly, terribly often, but it's a movie that you're glad you watched when you did, and you saw people, 1970s exploring the possibilities of cinema and new and quirky ways of storytelling, which kind of is refreshing. There are so many linear narratives with a small cast of characters that I've seen lately, maybe because I've been watching a few of the Mumblecore movies, which of course have those limitations because of budget and because of the aesthetic environment that they work in. But Nashville was a nice rewatch for me. I really did enjoy it. I did see him, speaking of 1970s, see, there's another good segue for you. I watched a recent film, Paul Thomas Anderson's Inherent Vice, with Joaquin Phoenix and a cast of other people. Benicio del Toro's in it as well. And, about 1970s. It's based on a Thomas Pynchon novel, 1970s kind of meta post linear narrative, absurdist, crazy fucking movie about a hippie private eye investigating various bits and pieces in there. Martin Short's got a really weird role in there, and it's not a perfect film by any means, but it is quirky and interesting and transgressive and basically bugfuck crazy. Reese Witherspoon's even interesting in it, and Reese Witherspoon's somebody that I haven't had a lot of time for since Freeway, basically, since she got that her jaw moved forward surgically and her chin suddenly looks really fucking weird. I haven't had a lot of time for her, but in this one she's kind of good. She filmed her stuff in 4 days, but Phoenix is one of those actors who's such a chameleon that even though he's kind of, you're drawn to him as an actor when you're watching the roles, each one of his roles is significantly different. And he definitely has the chops as an actor. He's just one of those really non-mainstream-looking actors who does lead roles as a character actor kind of piece. So Inherent Vice, I enjoyed that. the 1970 stuff. Little bits and pieces of business in there are great, like the sign on the wall and the brothel that he visits, which is kind of cool. Actually posted that on Facebook. Yeah, I enjoyed that a lot. Less enjoyable was The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug, which I hadn't seen. The Hobbit films and the Lord of the Rings films are not really my thing. I tried to read Tolkien, but I found it just badly written, even when I was forced to try to read The Hobbit at school. It's lots of running around and jumping around and lots of CG and lots of shooting things and stabbing things with no real blood showing and lots of tall people pretending to be short people and New Zealand trying to pretend it's not New Zealand. Well, I love New Zealand, don't get me wrong, I've been there a few times and New Zealand's a great place and I love the culture of the people of New Zealand, but this Hobbit stuff just has to go. And then I saw a very, very, very low budget horror film from Norway, because this podcast is a broad church, and it's called Thael, and it's about a couple of guys whose job it is to clean up kind of places that have been messed up by violent death. So they go and clean up murder sites and all sorts of things like that, and they're cleaning out an isolated country place, and they find a woman who seems very traumatized, a young naked woman who's very traumatized, but it turns out she's not human. She's a mythological woodland creature from the Scandinavian region. And it was done on a very low budget. It's not too bad. I mean, it's not perfect. It's got its limitations based on a $10,000 budget. The CG for the woodland creatures they have in it is very ropey. But it's not bad. It's one of those kind of small budget things where they wanted to tell a story and they managed to tell quite a different one. Turns out that what she uses is a Hulden, H-U-L-D-E-N, I think it is. A woodland kind of nymph, in a sense, that somebody has been experimenting on for a very long time. And it's kind of worth checking out, though. It's takes you out of the usual stuff of kind of Anglo-Saxon mythologies into kind of Nordic mythologies. And the actors are quite engaging in what they do. And there's a nice little twist at the end of it, which is satisfying, but kind of telegraphs itself, and where it is satisfying, I don't mind a plot point telegraphing itself, but this one did. And it was on SBS2, if you know Australian Television, which is their multicultural broadcaster, and I'm really going to have to try to find more movies from SBS2 and kind of expand my range of non-English speaking quirk cinema. So that's about it for what I've been watching. I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, we're going to do this in reverse chronological order, because what the fuck? And I'm going to look first at 1950 Stage Fright, starring Jane Wyman, Richard Todd, Marlena Dietrich, Alastair Sim, and Joyce Grenfell.
When Detective Smith was called backstage to investigate the Inwood murder, it looked like a rather routine affair. He hardly expected it to lead to the most dangerous adventure of his life, romance. The case presented a few clues and a few bodies. A very dead body. A very heavenly body. A very suspicious body. And finally, a very charming busybody, who started out by getting tangled in the strings of the mystery and finished by getting tied up in the strings of his heart.
All the trouble to protect my reputation, covering up the accident, destroying that dreadful dress.
I didn't destroy it. So long as I have the dress, I'm the one who decides how long this show will run. And everything else. Do you understand?
You fool! There goes evidence that could have helped you!
Well, you're not to say things against Charlotte. I'm doing all this for her sake. You're just jealous of her!
Let them say, if they like, it's satirical.
Sounds to me remarkably like blackmail. I think I'd better call the police.
Yes, do call the police, Miss Inwood. We'll talk to them together.
Who are you?
Okay, so Stage Fright is a 1950 crime thriller, an English one. It was directed by Alfred Hitchcock. The writers were Whitfield Cook, who wrote a screenplay, and Alma Revel, who was the wife of Alfred Hitchcock. She adapted the screenplay. It stars Marlene Dietrich, Jane Wyman, Michael Wilding, Richard Todd, Alasdair Sim, Sybil Thorndike, Kay Walsh, Joyce Grenville, Andre Moreau, and Hitchcock's daughter Patricia, playing a character that we meet at a fun fair called Chubby Bannister, which is a horrible thing to name your daughter in a movie, but there you go. The story is fairly simple, but not so simple in some ways. It's a little bit of a difficult one to talk about without spoilers, but I'll give it a go. The storyline, according to IMDb, and these things are a little bit wobbly at times. Jonathan Cooper is wanted by the police, who suspect him of killing his lover's husband. His friend Eve Gill offers to hide him, and Jonathan explains that to her that his lover, actress Charlotte Inwood, played by Marlene Dietrich, is the real murderer. Eve decides to investigate for herself, but when she meets the detective in charge of the case, she starts to fall in love. Now, that's pretty much it. Jane Wyman plays Eve Gill. Jane Wyman had just come off winning the Academy Award a couple of years before for Johnny Belinda, where she played a deaf-mute rape victim. Again, that's pretty much what it is. Marlene Dietrich, of course, playing Charlotte. She's a stage singer, actress, and dancer. She's very famous, and she's got that femme fatale thing happening. So it's a nice role for Marlene Dietrich at this stage of her career. She was in her late 40s, and but still looking stunningly good. Richard Todd plays Jonathan Cooper. Richard Todd, people know him most from things like the Dam Busters. He was one of those kind of upper-class British actors of a certain time in the middle of the century. Not a tall man, but he had the virtue of longevity. He lived a very long time, and he was in some ways a limited actor. He could only play a certain kind of role, and in this one he's slightly miscast as Cooper, who may or may not be a murderer, but he's definitely involved in some way in the cover-up of a murder. Then we also have a couple of people who steal the movie, pretty much, and that is Alasdair Sim playing Commodore Gill, Eve Gill's father. Sybil Thorndike playing his estranged wife, Mrs. Gill. And there's a really nice cameo in the movie from Joyce Grenville, who plays a lady running a charity store where people shoot tin ducks with little BB guns to raise money for charity at a country fair. Now, this movie came in an interesting place in the career of Alfred Hitchcock. He'd just made Under Capricorn, which was a notorious failure. And this movie came between Under Capricorn, Big Failure, and the resurgence of Hitchcock as a director with Strangers on a Train. It sits right in that kind of sweet spot between success and failure, and it's neither a success nor a failure in some ways. But I find it an interesting movie for all the wrong reasons, according to Hitchcock. And that that makes it, for me, an even more interesting film. Part of the research I did for this movie is from my Hitchcock Bible, which is Hitchcock by Truffaut, the definitive study written by Francois Truffaut. And Hitchcock has some interesting things to say about Stage Fright, which kind of puts a slightly different picture on the movie for a certain extent. Now, one of the interesting things is right at the start of the film, the very first thing you see on the screen is really important to the end of the movie and to the culmination of the plot. And I found that kind of interesting. The word safety is involved with it, but it's not really the safest of things possible. This movie got lambasted at the time, and it was harshly dealt with by a lot of critics, including the French critics or the Cahiers de Cinema type people. They really didn't like the fact that Here it is in Hitchcock's own words. I'll tell you what it says. I did one thing in that picture that I never should have done. I put in a flashback that was a lie. And right at the start of the film, there's a flashback with an unreliable narrator. That narrator being the Richard Todd character, telling Eve, played by Jane Wyman, why he's hiding from the police. It involves the fact, according to him, that Charlotte came to his house and she had a dress stained with blood at the front of it, and she wanted him to help her cover up the murder of her husband. She needs him to get a dress for her so she can wear a dress to the theatre because she's going on stage that night. And so he decides to help her because he's in love with her, pretty much. So Jonathan decides that what he's going to do is go back to her house, sneak in, get the dress, make it look like somebody had broken in and killed her husband, and then get out. It doesn't quite play out that way for various reasons. And so he ultimately, the husband is discovered, and that's where Michael Wilding's character, Ordinary Smith, his middle initial is O, and Eve decides to call him Ordinary for that reason. And Michael Wilding was an actor who didn't look anything but ordinary. He had kind of matinee idol looks. He was aristocratic and a good actor, a very good actor. And in this one, he's got a kind of easygoing charm about him, which is kind of nice and relaxed. He had problems in his career. One of the big problems that he had in his career was he was epileptic, and of course that limited his opportunities as an actor, particularly on stage and on film. And ultimately in his 60s he had to end his career, and he died a bit at the age of 66, falling down a flight of stairs during an epileptic fit. You've got to remember, this was in the days when epilepsy couldn't easily be managed by medication the way it is now, and if people keep to their medication, the incidence of epileptic fits are enormously reduced. That really wasn't an option at the time. There are a number of people in show business who suffered from that, Bud Abbott being one of the other big examples. And Michael Wilding also had a great career in the 1940s in English cinema, starring in kind of romantic musical comedies with an actress called Anna Neagle, who I've seen a couple of Anna Neagle movies that she starred in with Michael Wilding, and they're inexplicable because she tries to play women much younger than her age. They're very kind of frothy and women's pictures, but women's pictures of a particularly kind of saccharine kind in some ways. From a kind of film buff's viewpoint, they're a very interesting film to watch, but they're not really a very good film to watch, if you know what I mean. It shows this popular culture that times have changed so much that we find it kind of weird to look at. There are a lot of kind of big frothy frocks and things in them, and they were incredibly popular movies, the Anna Neagle, Michael Wilding films in England at the time, but these days they haven't aged well. They do turn up very occasionally on free-to-air television. I think there was one on Gem, one of the Australian channels here recently, and that's where I saw it, in fact, and they're just a weird artifact of a certain time in English film history. But at the time, they were very, very popular. And Wilding is kind of cool. His detective, Inspector Smith, is charming. And you wonder why he's single, in a sense, because Jane Wyman, for all of her skills as a certain type of actor, of course, her Oscar-winning role in Johnny Belinda is incredibly good. She's kind of miscast in this one. She's cast for about 10 years younger than her actual age. But her Eve, who was educated in America, hence the slight American accent that is essayed by Miss Wyman in the movie, is studying at RADA, the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts. And so she starts this investigation while they're hiding out the guy that she's smitten with, being the Richard Todd character. She hides out at her father's house. Now, her father is played, of course, by Alastair Sim. And Alastair Sim steals the movie. Oh, totally steals the movie. I've never seen a Hitchcock film where a minor character kind of is so much of a focal point. You've got to remember, this is a movie with Marlene Dietrich in it, but nonetheless, Alistair Sim seals the movie. He's discussing the murder and the problems they've got, and the fact that there's this dress of Charlotte's that's covered in blood, and he studies the dress and finds out certain things about it and stuff like that. He's questioning very closely the Jonathan character, played by Richard Todd, while wearing a piano accordion, and he does little motifs on the piano accordion through various bits of the conversation, which are quite cute. And he's just a charming character and quite resourceful too. Both him and his daughter are very resourceful characters. Eve is a resourceful character in her own way, and she decides that what she's got to do is get close to Charlotte. So what she does is pretends to be her dresser in the theater and bribes the actual dresser to let her do that. And so she's got to become another character. So in real life, she's got to use her training as an actor to pretend to be someone else. So she gets close to Charlotte and tries to investigate and get evidence for Charlotte having committed the murder. Now, it's a kind of interesting turnabout. It's almost like, not quite, but it's got very much in the flavour of 39 Steps or Ministry of Fear, or one of those movies where you have amateur sleuths getting into unusual situations and trying to unravel mysteries. Now, things aren't quite what he thinks they are, but she and her father, her mother doesn't believe any of this. Her mother's just totally ignorant of all. Played by Dame Sybil Thorndike, who was very much a more serious actor. And seeing Sybil Thorndike playing with Alistair Sim is a joy in this movie. There's just a lot of silly little bits and fun in this, and it's playful in a lot of ways. There's a scene where there's a charity event at the country fair, and Charlotte, played by Marlene Dietrich, has to go along. And there are bits in there where Eve has to pretend to be the dresser part of the time and pretend to be herself at other times and kind of switch from one to the other. It's almost farcical. It's like a French farce in some ways there. And the garden party is interesting. That's where she meets Alistair Sim's character, meets up with Joyce Grenfell's character, who's running the shooting the tin ducks thing at the fair. And he has an idea to try to freak Charlotte out and to kind of goad her into a confession, which is quite clever in its way and leads to a couple of those Hitchcock moments where things don't go right and the person involved has to adapt to them quickly. And there's a really nice scene at the lovely duck shooting stall between Alistair Sim, a couple of character actors, and Joyce Grenfell, which is really a lot of fun. And it takes you totally out of the seriousness of the murder and takes you out of the seriousness of the movie and takes you out of the very dramatic ending the film has. But nonetheless, it's kind of welcome there. The movie does have those tonal shifts, which can be a little bit disconcerting, but they are a lot of fun. And the really weird thing, though, and this is reading from the Truffaut Hitchcock book, Hitchcock by Truffaut, where they had a conversation that got transcribed. Quite a little bit from the book, which is kind of interesting. Truffaut says, yes, that was funny, but I didn't care for Alistair Sim in the role of Jane Wyman's colourful father. I objected to the actor as well as the character. And Hitchcock said, here again is the trouble with shooting a film in England. They all tell you, he's one of our best actors, you've got to have him in your picture. It's that old local and national feeling, that insular mentality again. Aside from that, I had lots of problems with Jane Wyman. And one of the things was, I ran into great difficulties with Jane. In her disguise as a lady's maid, she should have been rather unglamorous after all. She was supposed to be impersonating an unattractive maid. But every time she saw the rushes and saw how she looked alongside Marlene Dietrich, she would burst into tears. She couldn't accept the idea that her face being in character while Dietrich looked so glamorous. So she kept improving her appearance every day, and that's how she failed to maintain the character. Which is kind of cool. There's a few things in that. First thing is that neither Truffaut nor Hitchcock loved Alistair Sim doing what he did in this film. But from my viewpoint, seeing it now, and yes, I'm going to disagree with two of the biggest film directors in the world, I think Alistair Sim is fantastic in this film. I really love him. I think he makes up for the weaknesses of some of the other characters, the kind of slight wrongness about casting Richard Todd in the role, though Richard Todd was considered a kind of romantic lead at the time, and he was playing against type to a certain extent. And Marlene Dietrich, of course, is good as the kind of femme fatale in the film. She gets to sing a couple of songs. The Laziest Girl in Town's one of them. And that part is enjoyable. And she is kind of really, there's a kind of a kind of subterranean current of evil about the character, which is kind of nice. And you've got Jane Wyman, who is cast wrongly in this film, I think, to a big extent. And it could have done with a younger actor and somebody with a little more range, maybe, because A, she's got to play a kind of working class English girl in one bit, and another bit she's got to play her own character, Aviv. And there's not enough differentiation between those. Hitchcock's right about that. The fact that Jane Wyman should have kind of changed gears to play the bits where she's pretending to be the maid, and doesn't really achieve that in the film. Now, there's some really good scenes toward the end which involve a very primitive and 1950 attempt at bugging part of the theatre. And the theatre is a great scene for these kind of playouts of murder mysteries, particularly when violence is involved. It's got nooks and crannies and shadows and inexplicable equipment and large spaces and small spaces. It's a really nice place to shoot this kind of an ending to a film. And the denouement, where the bad person ultimately gets killed by accident, is pretty damn good. I really like that part of it. I like that a lot. But it is a kind of lesser Hitchcock film. I don't think Hitchcock was particularly happy with it. I know that the critics at the time weren't happy with it and felt incredibly betrayed by the unreliable narrator at the start. But from our point of view, that unreliable narration at the start is good. It's something we're now used to. It's something that we've grown accustomed to from any number of modern films. And it does make the movie feel a little less old and dated than it would otherwise. And I like a good unreliable narrator. I love being sucked in by them, particularly. If I get pulled along by a movie and I'm getting involved with it and I believe what a character says and then the character turns out to be full of shit, I don't feel betrayed by that at all. I feel delighted. I like that. It's like a magic trick. You think it's going to go one way, but then it goes another. That stuff is a joy for me in cinema. But it's worth seeing. The movie's definitely worth seeing. I don't know. There's a DVD release, a very cheap DVD release in Australia a few years ago, which I picked up, and I'm sure you can pick it up fairly cheaply or find it online very cheaply, if not for free, depending on your whimsy. But see it for the secondary roles would be my best advice on this one. There's some nice bits of acting in there, and it's one of Hitchcock's movies that does have a lot of humour to it. And the humour partly comes from the script, but it also partly comes from character actors who know their stuff really well. Alastair Sim, Joyce Grenfell, people like that, they're so much fun. But I'm going to take another break, and then we're going to get to a more serious and a more accomplished Alfred Hitchcock movie, being 1946's Notorious, with Ingrid Bergman, Cary Grant, Claude Rains, and a number of other interesting character actors.
It's not 'cause she wouldn't, it's not 'cause she shouldn't, and you know it's not 'cause she couldn't. It's simply because
I'm the laziest gal in town. Nothing ever worries me, no one ever hurries me. I take pleasure leisurely, even when I kiss. But when I kiss, they want some more, and wanting more becomes a bore. It isn't worth the fighting for, so I tell them this. It's not 'cause I wouldn't, it's not 'cause I shouldn't, and you know it's not 'cause I couldn't. It's simply because I'm the laziest gal in town. The these girls get money to burn. Every proposition I turn down, way down. It's not cause I wouldn't, it's not cause I shouldn't, and you know, it's not cause I couldn't, it's simply because I'm the laziest gal in town. My poor heart is aching to bring home the bacon, and if I'm alone and forsaken, it's simply because I'm the laziest gal in town. Though I'm more than willing to learn how these girls get money to burn, every proposition I turn down, way down. It's not cause I wouldn't, it's not cause I shouldn't, and you know, it's not cause I couldn't, it's simply because I'm the laziest gal in town.
That, of course, was Marlene Dietrich singing The Laziest Girl in Town. On to other Hitchcock and Notorious. Now, I'd heard about Notorious for years before I saw it. It wasn't previously as available as some of the more recent Hitchcock films on any reasonable medium. But I came at it from the back door, in a sense, and I don't mean that in any anal way. I was watching some extras on Mission Impossible 2 on the disc for that, and they had Robert Towne, who did a lot of the script doctoring on that script, saying that he borrowed wholesale from Hitchcock's Notorious when he made Mission Impossible 2. That's the one set in Sydney with all the motorbikes and the knife fighting and all of that kind of shit. And I thought, well, if the guy who wrote Chinatown borrowed from this movie, then it's got to be at least worth checking out. And I like Hitchcock anyway, so what I might do is bide my time, put it on the list of things to find. And eventually, of course, I have found a copy of Notorious. The best summary of the Precis, or at least the start of the plot, comes from some guy called Francois Truffaut. I'm actually reading it from the book because it's so concise and perfect. I thought I'd do it. In America at the end of the war, a Nazi agent is sentenced to jail. His daughter, Alicia, Ingrid Bergman, who was never involved in his activities, leads a fast life. One day, a government agent named Devlin, Cary Grant, approaches her with a request that she undertake a secret mission. She accepts and they go to Rio together. They fall in love, but Devlin is wary of the former playgirl and maintains a certain distance between them. Alicia's assignment is to establish contact with Sebastian Claude Rains, a former friend of her father's, who harbours in his home a group of prominent Nazi refugees in Brazil. Alicia succumbs to establishing contact and becomes a regular visitor to Sebastian's home. He falls in love with her and proposes marriage. She hopes Devlin will object, but when he fails to do so, she accepts the offer. So that's the start of it. It is Mission Impossible 2 to that extent. And there's that love triangle there. Then, you know, it's a very kind of sophisticated concept for a movie made in 1946. A man loves a woman, but for reasons of national security, he basically gets her to act as an undercover agent by marrying another man. That's pretty heavy shit for 1946. And it's done very, very well. Now, I'm going to play a clip, it's about 2 and a bit minutes, of the first meeting between Cary Grant's character, Devlin, and Ingrid Bergman's character, which I kind of like. I really think that this is some of the best dialogue in a Hitchcock film as far as meet-cute is concerned.
Would you care to pause for some refreshments, Mr. Hall? Jins.
Alicia, were you really followed by a policeman? It sounds very exciting.
I'm going to shoot it out with him tomorrow.
Okay, he's had enough, so have you.
Don't be silly. The important drinking hasn't started yet.
Everybody down here's got a stuffed fish hanging on the wall. Where'd they get it? Never seen a fish.
How about you, handsome? Haven't I seen you somewhere before? Well, it doesn't matter. I like party crashers.
He's not a party crasher. I brought him.
Oh, Mr. Hopkins.
I wouldn't mind being followed by a cop.
Wouldn't think
of it. I hate low, underhanded people like policemen pussyfooting after you. Of course, I'm a marked woman, you know? I'm liable to blow up the Panama Canal any minute now. You want some ice in it?
No, thank you.
It's not becoming for a lovely girl like you to be worried about policemen. You won't be tomorrow.
Oh, really?
We sail at 10.
Really? We just sail away.
You show me your fish and I'll show you a liar.
What this party no needs fish. Is a little gland treatment.
We better start breaking up, Alicia. I have to be on board at 9. 1 week in Havana and this whole thing about your father will have blown over.
Do you love me, Commodore?
You're a very beautiful woman.
I'll have another drink to appreciate that.
Where are you going?
Fishing.
This time of night, you're mad.
How about you? Still
What's
drinking?
What's the difference? There's no fish day or night.
Do you know something? I like you.
Well, I'll see you on board at Alicia at 9 o'clock.
Oh, I have to think that over.
Well, you don't have to pack. We'll pick up some things in Havana.
I think I'll have to leave them here to dry out a little.
I'm very sorry. You all have to go. It has been a perfectly hideous party.
There's one more drink left to appease. Shame about the ice.
What is?
Gone.
Who's gone?
The ice. Why do you like that song?
Because it's a lot of hooey. There's nothing like a love song to give you a good laugh.
That's right.
It's stuffy in here, isn't it?
Might be.
What about... We have a picnic.
Outside?
Yeah, it's too stuffy in here for a picnic. Want to finish that?
Shame to leave it.
You're quite a boy. My car is outside.
Naturally.
Want to go for a ride?
Very much. What about your guests?
They'll crawl out under their own steam. I'm going to drive. That's understood.
Don't you need a coat?
You'll do.
I kind of like that. This is a weird movie from a couple of points of view. First one is, and this is a bit of a rarity in some ways, the male protagonist is underwritten and the female protagonist is written pretty well. And I don't know how much of that's due to the script and how much of that's due to the charisma of Ingrid Bergman, but her character, Alicia, is really a complex character. She starts out as a kind of alcoholic party girl whose father's just been jailed for being a Nazi, and she's being followed by the FBI and who knows who else, and that of course has put her under a certain amount of pressure. And you know, she's nothing like her father. Politically, she's nothing like her father. And so in order to prove it and in order to kind of get them off her back, she agrees to on this mission down to Brazil. She then of course falls in love with Cary Grant, and you know, who wouldn't under the circumstances? But she's then asked to do something with a man with whom she had a previous relationship, being the Claude Rains character, Alexander Sebastian. And she wants Cary Grant's character to tell her, don't do it, but he says, do it. And that's really a kind of turning point for the character. She does it, and whether she's doing it by being out of anger to Devlin or because she does have that patriotism, it's a bit of a kind of debatable point there. But regardless of that, she goes ahead with it, marries Sebastian, and is eventually sussed out as a spy in his own home. One of the people who susses him out, there are a couple of them, there are some really nasty-looking characters in this movie, which is always a lovely thing. one of the people who susses him out is Ivan Trissolt playing Eric Mathis. He's a Nazi conspirator. And the mother of Sebastian, played by Leopoldine Constantine, Madame Anna Sebastian, who is one of Hitchcock's best female villains. She's a nasty piece of work. She wants to keep her son close by her, even though he's middle-aged. She's a dyed-in-the-wool Nazi and really full-on with it, and doesn't particularly like her son's choice in wife. And that makes for a complicated thing, and she is chillingly cold in this movie. Really nice piece of acting. Leopoldine Constantine was a very famous Austrian actress before World War II and before the Germans came in. She was well known for being a part of the Deutsches Theater in Berlin. She was in Romeo and Juliet, A Winter's Tale, Midsummer Night's Dream, all of these Shakespearean plays in the early part of the 20th century in Germany. She escaped to America in 1938 and spent time basically, you know, any kind of work she could get. She couldn't speak English very well. So she spent some time after moving to America as a factory worker. But then she did some really intensive language study, and then she got the supporting role in Notorious in 1946. She played Claude Rains' mother, although she was only 3 years older than him. And she died in America in she actually died in Vienna in 1965, so she moved back to Europe after the war and spent the rest of her life there. So, you know, really interesting person. Really nice character actor face too, but in this one she's playing a Nazi very chillingly. And that brings up that really interesting thing about anti-Nazi actors playing Nazis in Hollywood in the 1930s and the 1940s. And it's like they put extra effort into it. They really wanted to show how fucking nasty Nazis were. And people like her and Conrad Veidt and all the other actors who played Nazis, who were actually victims of the Nazis during those years, really did put the venom that they felt for the characters they were playing into the characters, and they really did intensify it. And she's a nasty woman. She's the one that comes up with the idea of how the Nazis are going to deal with Alicia once they find out that she's a spy, and they do it in a particularly evil way. I'm not going to tell you what it is, because you can find out for yourself what it is. But there's a scene where there's a surreptitious meeting between Devlin and Alicia on a park bench, where he thinks she's drunk and she's gone on the piss again, and it's kind of disgusted with her, and the meeting doesn't end well. It's a surreptitious meeting for her to update him on what's going on with the Nazis. And it's a really well-played piece of work. Notorious does have some scenes that are among Hitchcock's best of any era, and that's particularly one of them. There's also the MacGuffin of the movie, which is the fact that there are samples of uranium ore being hidden in Alexander's house in wine bottles, vintage wine bottles. And there's a couple of kind of tense scenes with Devlin and Alicia involved with these wine bottles full of uranium, or must be pitch blend or something like that. The movie script was actually written before the atomic bombs, were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and they were asking a couple of physicists about various things for the plot of the film, and got themselves very nearly into some deep trouble about it, because they have problems first off because the producer didn't know what an atomic bomb was in early 1945 when they were making the script, and then they went around asking questions to find out stuff, so yeah, they'd at least have some kind of plausibility of what they were putting into the screenplay. And there were some physicists who kind of backed off really fast and said, no, we can't talk about that stuff, it's top secret. But the MacGuffin with the uranium is a good one for the movie, and it does give more of a chance for Devlin and Alicia to get together after she's married and ensconced in the household of Alexander Sebastian. And, yeah, there's the usual bits of tension there with the various Nazis, and they've all got really evil Nazi faces. It's a lovely bit of casting with the various Nazis who are hanging around this household. And then we have Claude Rains. One of the things Hitchcock has said in that book by Truffaut is that you've got to have a strong villain in the movie. The stronger the villain is, the better the movie. And that's pretty much true with any film. You have use just a kind of very broad example. James Bond films. If the villain is really, really good in a James Bond movie, then the James Bond movie is really, really good. If the villain is kind of weak and wishy-washy, the way they had in Moonraker, say, or Tomorrow Never Dies, then the movie is much lesser. There's not enough push for the protagonist. But in this one, you've got a really nice villain, Alexander Sebastian, played by Claude Rains, because there's an ambiguity about him. He's a man in love. Yes, he's a Nazi, but he's in love with Ingrid Bergman. And he's at times vulnerable because of that. And then, of course, he's being henpecked by his mother, who doesn't like his choice of wife, and those kind of things. So they were, even though you know he's a kind of evil character, he's not a character of only two dimensions. They do try to flesh him out a little bit, and that works in strong favour of the movie. Cary Grant, less so. His character, he has the kind of thankless role because he's got to be a bit of a bastard in this one. He's got to let the woman he loves go and kind of seduce and then marry another man. Cary Grant's a very sophisticated actor and a very charismatic one. I don't think there's any man in cinema that was quite as charismatic as him. But when it comes to playing the kind of nuance you need for a character like Devlin, you need somebody that's going to give a little more than charming. And I think that if there's a weak spot in the kind of triangle of this film, I think it may be Cary Grant. I think there are times when he does show some subtlety to it, but I just got the idea. Maybe it's because Claude Rains and Ingrid Bergman are so good that he kind of falls into a shadow by comparison. But I didn't find him as interesting in this one as I did. Oh, I have found him in other movies, things like Charade and all that kind of thing. But having said that, I'm really glad that I waited to watch Notorious. I think that it's a movie that I can appreciate for the subtleties, for the twists and turns, for Ingrid Bergman's acting as well. She's incredibly beautiful in this one. But she also plays a character who's kind of morally ambiguous. She's a bit of a playgirl. She's got a problem with alcohol to a certain extent. And nonetheless, she's intelligent and sharp. And again, very, very sexy, which is exactly what's called for with the role. It's a movie that you've got to watch carefully too. A lot of Hitchcock films, you can watch North by Northwest and kind of, you don't have to be giving your whole attention to the screen while you're watching it, and you can still get the gist of it. But this one's got a lot more subtlety to it. And of course, North by Northwest is the role that Grant did again with Hitchcock in 1959. Overall, I like the film a lot. I like the fact that it does go to where it goes to with that triangle and does have that problem of two people in love who, because of their political circumstances and because of the world they live in, have to be separated. And then there's another man who's in love, but he's not sure whether the woman he marries loves him. Of course, ultimately proves that she doesn't, but he's also holding a lot of secrets there while being under the thumb of his mother and a bunch of very, very ruthless people indeed. But if you haven't seen Notorious, or you haven't seen it in a while, check it out. It's a lot of really nice entertainment too. There are times in movies when plots do meander, they go down their own paths, they throw unexpected things at us sometimes, you think they're going to go down one path and they find an entirely new one that you hadn't even thought about. And this movie's a little bit like that. It's a scenic route kind of movie as far as the plot's concerned. And it's, you know, those kind of movies are always a joy to watch. They're always a bit of fun. You want the hero and the heroine to get together. But in Hitchcock movies, it's never a kind of unambiguous getting together, with the possible exception of a piece of fluff like North by Northwest. When you think of things like The Birds or Marnie or any of the other movies, or worst case scenario, Vertigo. Hitchcock romances are never exactly hunky-dory at the end of the film. But this is a spy movie so good that they can kind of regenerate it in the beginning of the 21st century as an action film and present the plot to a whole new audience. Now, there are a couple of Hitchcock films I still haven't seen. Jamaica Inn I haven't seen, and I'm looking forward to watching that fairly soon. But, yeah, I think I'm going to have to do that. Find directors that are really famous and that I really like, and find the obscure works of theirs and kind of explore that for a little bit. It'll be a bit of fun. You can get so tired of just watching the usual suspects, if you know what I mean. And I don't mean the usual suspects movie. I mean the usual movies from certain directors. And, yeah, you learn their tricks and their tropes, and you kind of know them inside out. But there are still some, you know, paths to tread there that I haven't gone down before, and I'm looking forward to doing that. But anyway, that's about it this time around. I would like to say at the end of the podcast, congratulations to Tansy Rayner Roberts, Alicia Krasenstein, and Alexandra Pierce for winning the Hugo Award for their podcast, Galactic Suburbia. It's really well deserved, guys. And Tansy is also a Patreon subscriber to this podcast. So good on you all. And I'll be back soon with another Martian Driving podcast and then another Paleo Cinema podcast. So in the meantime, keep watching good films. Hug the people you love. Keep your feet dry in cold weather. And I'll be back soon with another podcast. And by the way, here are the credits as usual. And here are the credits for the Patreon subscribers to the podcast in the style of movie credits. I'd like to thank Tom the Focus Puller, Sarah the Special Effects Technician, Ian the Caterer, Grant the Technicolor Consultant, Claire the Script Doctor, Gary the Prop Master, Morris the Musical Director, Jan the Dialect Coach, Armin the Key Grip, Matt the Rattlesnake Wrangler, Elaine our Scientific Advisor, Julia, our casting director, Chris, our camera operator, Christopher, our gaffer, Miss Jane, our wardrobe mistress, Tansy, the Foley artist, Alyssa, our location scout, Mark, our second unit director, Paul, our special makeup effects director, Tammy, the donut wrangler, Tim, the New York unit director, and Rabbi Steve, our spiritual advisor. We also have Paul, who does the special makeup effects, and Kathleen, who has yet to have a job in the credits. So thank you to everybody who supports the podcast and to the people who listen to it. If you want to support the podcast with some micropayments, please go to patreon.com/paleocinema, and I'll catch all of you next time.